sent me emails afterwards to ask me to make things less abstract. And I will try to change here on this side.
Hopefully that will appeal to you, but there's also a risk that the change will only appeal to those people who didn't show up today. That will be it. Okay. That will not be good. But okay. So I guess today I want to start by trying to introduce you to the idea of how to think about the curvature of a curved manifold from an intrinsic point of view. And then we will derive the Einstein equation. Hello? And then talk about some a very interesting phenomenon like the gravitational wave, gravitational radiation, and black holes. So let's start by talking about the curvature. So can you think about any way to say try to describe see the curvature of a curved manifold from some way that is independent of some embedding of the surface or of the curved manifold? I mean, do you have some ideas to suggest, please? Very good, very good. So one way to rephrase that is to say that probably say a parallel, say straight lines, and now they can cross each other, right? So just to draw a picture, let's say it's here. We can have two longitudes that it seems pretty clear that they are parallel to each other when they cross the equator, but they can meet at the north and south pole. To make that intuition really precise, one has to first define what do they mean by parallel, say straight lines on a curved manifold. So first of all, we have to say what we mean by straight lines on a curved manifold. So that leads to the notion of a geodesic curve. So first, what do we mean by a geodesic? So here's again a question to you. Do you have some thoughts on, say, how to generalize the concept of a straight line from the flat space to a curved space? Do you have some thought on that, please? Very good. So last time we see that the distance, say, between two points is like this. So for a curve, xi of t, so now if we just try to do some a variational calculus to that formula, given our limited amount of time, I will save you the algebra, which you can find in almost any textbooks, either on differential geometry or on GR. I save you the algebra, but the conclusion is that if we try to look at what is the minimal length curve, then they are described by the following differential equation, which is second order and takes this form. I will tell you what that symbol is in terms of the metric. So here, the index is being summed over j and k. Okay, so first of all, I have to tell you what that is. That is a function on the whole manifold that depends on the metric and its first derivative. So gamma ijk is so the index L is being summed over here. So from here, you can see that if a dimetric tensor is constant, like in a flat space, then a gamma vanishes. And what you get is just the second order derivative of xi with respect to the parameter parameterizing the curve has to vanish. That means that it is a straight line. So what happens when we move from a flat space to a curved space is just that we have to insert that object to the equation to figure out what are the generalization of concept of straight lines to the curved space. In terms of formulas, it's like that. I mean, there really is some quite beautiful story behind this, but yeah, I think today we will save you off some of the very beautiful stuff just to get to the, say, physics more directly. So that is what we mean by a geodesic. Now we know what is a geodesic. Now we can try to describe more precisely what we mean by parallel straight lines, parallel straight lines on curved manifold may cross. So the right way to think about it is that take two geodesics very close to each other, and then measure their a relative, say, distance or say relative deviation from each other as a function of the parameter of parameterizing the curve. So say the two curves are x I of t, y I of t. So what one does is that one define vi, which is the difference of them, and then calculate how does vi change. Well, just to write down in terms of really down-to-earth formulas, basically what one does is to calculate the acceleration, the relative acceleration of the two curves with respect to each other. So it's, well, vi probably is something that suggests it's more like a velocity. So I will change it. I will change it as delta xi. So what we want to do is calculate AI, which is very roughly. So the formulas that I write down today is going, at least for this part, is not, I mean, it's going to be quite impressionistic. Okay? There are some really beautiful way to rewrite it in terms of really a rigorous way, but let's don't bother with that. This really will really give you the ideas right. So basically, one try to describe how much these two straight lines are tend to go away or go towards each other by calculating the relative acceleration, and that turns out to have a simple form. So that turns out to be a very good characterization of the local curvature of the curved manifold. So that turns out to be a very good characterization. And it can be written in the following way. Well, make the index right. So let me tell you. So here, that is a 1,3 rank 1,3 tensor. It's a tensor field. It is depend on where we are on the whole curved manifold. Okay. And well, I changed my notation a little bit. what I'm doing. So let me change it. I apologize that. And this XC is, let me call it delta XC. That's right. So what this formula says is that the relative acceleration between two geodesics, first of all, is proportional to the separation, which is this a vector of the two curves. That's just something trivial, because if you really zoom in to a local region, basically the two things are, I mean, it's like the relative acceleration is the scales are linearly as how far they are separated from each other. If you just see the picture here, so there is a sphere here. If you take two lines very close to each other, then locally they look almost parallel. But then if you separate these two lines farther away, still quite close to each other, you will start to see that the relative acceleration toward each other, it becomes bigger and bigger. And in particular, it scales linearly with respect to the deviation. So that is that term here. So those two terms is just, so the t's are the tangent vector along the geodesics, and to zero order, I mean the two tangent vectors are the same, so one does not need to bother. It's the tangent vector on which, so this is really in the limit where the two curves are very close to each other. The fact that there are two t's here rather than one t is also just the fact that if we think about reversing the direction of the parameterization, then the relative acceleration should remain the same. The sign should not change. So there are two t's there. Well, I'm really just giving you some really intuitive explanation. There are completely a rigorous and not so hard way to derive all these things, but it just will take us too long to really try to go through the derivation, although they are really beautiful and highly comprehensible.
In a scalar and vector, but I don't really understand.
So I guess by the definition that I gave you last time, so you think that is not a very helpful, or?
Don't particularly get a full grasp on.
Okay, so I guess the most down-to-earth way to understand it is that it is an object defined all over the manifold, and when you change the coordinates on the manifold, then the components transform in a very simple way. And if I have to write it out, then so I would write it out, B, C, D, A. When you do a transformation from, say, XA to YA, then R transform to R, okay, A bar, B bar, C bar, D bar, get it right, D, Y. So basically, the key property that you have to keep in mind is that when we do a coordinate transformation from one coordinate to another, then the components of the tensor transform in the following way. So that looks like a quite complicated thing, but really what it says is that basically each component has to transform linearly. So I mean, if you just focus on the component, focus on the single upper component A and A bar, then A and A bar they should be related by that matrix. That is a n by n matrix. So we are now on a n dimensional manifold. So there are n coordinates and A runs from 1 to n. Does that help? Okay, great. So that is indeed one very helpful way to characterize the curvature of a manifold without resorting to any unnecessary concept. And oh, by the way, so that equation turns out to be quite useful in something that we are not going to talk about, which is the study of the singularity theorems, which I can tell you what is the theorem, what do the theorems say. So the theorems say that in a gravitational system where basically all the matter constants and field constants are wrong, if they satisfy some energy condition, which basically says that the energy has to be, say, always say positive, cannot be negative, or always has, or say the energy has to be greater than the pressure. All of these are very natural and sensible conditions on a classical system. Okay. So if we impose some very sensible conditions on the energy and pressure, or in other words, on if we impose some very sensible conditions on the energy and pressure of some system, then when we turn on gravity, that system almost always have to have some singularity, either in the future or in the past, basically due to gravitational collapse. So that's a powerful theorem in the sense that it tells us that if we just want to restrict us to the classical physics with the gravity, then we almost always have to run into the problem of some singularity at where the classical field equations for both the matters, or say for the electric, the magnetic field, as well as for the gravitational field, all these classical field equations would have to break down or just don't make sense near the singularity. So that really just tells us that classical physics, including gravity, is a framework that is not complete by itself. Either one has to choose some, say, boundary conditions near the singularity, or more sensibly, as we know that the real world should really be described by quantum mechanics, one has to understand how does matter and other fields behave quantum mechanically near a region of singularity. Oh, by the way, sorry, I forgot to mention. A singularity, by a singularity, I mean a place. Well, singularities can mean many things, but if we just want to be simple-minded, then singularity means a place, some of the curvature invariants blow up. When I say it has to be a curvature invariant, what I mean is that it is imprecise to say that, say, some of the components of the curvature tensor blow up, because as I just showed you that the components of the curvature tensor transform under a coordinate transformation. So if we happen to choose a bad coordinate system, that may artificially introduce some divergences to some components. But once we say choose a better coordinate system, then we may be able to remove the singularity. So what we want to say is that there should be some invariant in some there should be some invariants built from the curvature tensor that say diverge. I will tell you how to build those a curvature invariant later. We are going to see them very soon. So I just want to repeat a statement, or just want to say emphasize the statement that there are really a set of really cool theorems which just say that if the matter behaves very reasonably and with the gravity, then things goes really bad. There will be singularities because a gravity just will try to collapse everything down to a small region so that the density is very high and the curvature will be very high. Okay. So so that's one way to characterize a curvature, which is very useful. There is another way to think about the curvature of a manifold. Does anyone have some idea? Okay, fine. Given our limited amount of time, I will just tell you. So that is basically, okay, we can still go back to that same picture here. Think about that longitude. Suppose we take that vector. Well, let me take this vector. If I parallel transport it along the equator to this longitude that is diametrically opposite to this one, I get a vector that looks like that. But if I parallel transport this vector along the longitude itself, then I get a vector that looks like that. So when I parallel two vectors, when I parallel transport two vectors to the same point along two different paths, they don't have to agree. Well, don't confuse what I'm talking about now with what I just talked about. I both use the words. In both cases, I use the word parallel, but really I mean two different things. In the first case, I mean two lines that are parallel to each other. And now, note that the paths that I transport these vectors don't have to be parallel to each other. In one case, the path is this. In the other case, the path is this. But I transport the same vector. Of course, I use the phrase parallel transport. That is another notion that I have to introduce. What do I mean by parallel transport? So what do I mean by that? On a curved space. So to understand that, we still just go back to the flat space case and then try to pick up some intuition and try to extract the gist of that and see which aspect that can be generalized to a curved space, which aspects are something that are just, say, accidental to the flat space case. That is always the idea when we try to generalize some concept from some special case to the more general cases. So on a flat space, like say the blackboard, if I have a vector at some point P, and then I have a point Q, I can parallel transport that vector you all understand what that means. I can either parallel transform along that path, I get a lat vector. I can also parallel transport along that path, get the same vector. So on the flat space case, the parallel transport is independent of the path that I choose. So what do I mean by a parallel transport? One way to characterize that, even just in the flat space case, is if I locally look at the path here, there will be, so if I call that vector, or more generally, I can talk about the tensor as I defined last time. I call it T, which stands for either a vector or higher rank tensor, it doesn't matter. And there is a vector, there is a tangent vector to the curve, which I call V. Then clearly, VI, DTJ, DXI vanish. That is a way to characterize what do I mean by parallel transport by this first order differential equation. There are j of them. Okay, sorry, there are n of them, where n is the dimension of the whole space, of the whole flat space. So you agree that is a way to characterize parallel transport. Do you or you don't?
Sorry. Where'd you get this term from here?
Okay, so intuitively what it means is that let's see. So I'm trying to define a tensor only along the curve. Right, I mean, because I'm parallel transporting it only along the curve, and I want to make sure as it is transported along the time, the curve, it doesn't change. So that's why the derivatives have to vanish. Let's see, so your question is that enough, or so certainly parallel transport implies that you agree with that. Right? So the question is whether that implies parallel transport, whether that gives a full characterization of parallel transport. Let's see. Yeah, it does. So think about the case where, say, choose a coordinate where V, choose a local coordinate system where V, where the tangent vector V is just really 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay. Then what that equation says, it's really just dTj dx1 is 0. So this really just says that, so this combination just tells us that along the curve. So that is, well, what I'm doing. There is a particular combination, vi partial partial xi. That is a combination that just tells us how something changes along the curve. When vi is the tangent vector to the curve, then vi times del by del xi is the operator that tells us how things changes along the curve. So now, our question would be just how to generalize that particular operator to a curve space. And that leads to the notion of covariant, the derivative, and connections. Again, there is a really beautiful story behind it. It's really beautiful. And it even can be generalized to something more general, just beyond transporting, say, vectors or tensors. It can be generalized to cases that can also be applied to particle physics. There are things like a gauge theory, which can be described by something that I'm not going to tell you about, but something that really is a more general notion I'm going to talk about than what I'm going to tell you about today. I just want to let you know that if you find these things not elegant enough for you, there is something more to be learned. I mean, there is something more beyond this that is really cool. So let me just, without proving anything, let me just tell you that the object that generalizes that, say, operator on curve space can be written, well, that's really stupid, because you can be written like that. So you change d by dxi to this triangle I, or how do you call this? I don't know. So that really says nothing if I don't tell you what that object is. So that object, again, acts on tensors. So it would suffice operationally just for me to tell you how does that operator act on tensors of various ranks. So I will just do that. So that operator acting on functions would be just the same as d by dxi acting on functions. But when it is acting on a vector, how do I call a vector? Pi. It gives us that there is still this derivative piece. I'm not sure about sign, but that's a convention. Sorry? Can't hear you. Well, there are finite number of choices we can just own. So that's how it acts on a vector. Now we can see how does it act on a do vector. Thanks. And one of them is a minus sign. I apologize, guys. It's never my talent to remember formulas. Unless the formula are really elegant. So these are really just some really, let me stop it. And more generally, you can have a higher rec tensor with both upper and lower components. The way to do it is really just a direct generalization of that. Without giving you the most general form, I will just show you how you do things like this. Okay. And then when you have, say, multiple ones, you will see yourself quite simply how to generalize it. I will just give you this case as an example. Well, the main point that should catches your eye is that somehow the gamma that appears over there reappear here. Okay. That's the thing that I hope that when you see these formulas that you make these connections to your, I mean, in your own mind. And there is really good reason for that. We are not going to really explain that, but it's actually quite clear why they reappear here. I will tell you, I mean, if you don't see what, I mean, you can think about it for a second. You probably will just figure it out yourself, at least intuitively. So that is what that object is, or how, or what does it do on tensors, on general tensors. In other words, if I have a tensor field T, and if it satisfies this equation, where VI is some curve, is the tangent on some curve, along some curve in a curved manifold, then T as a tensor defined on the curve can be thought of as picking one point and taking the tensor and taking the value of that tensor at that point and then parallel transport it. Okay. That tensor defined along the curve you get by parallel transport the object from a single point P to the whole curve would satisfy that equation. So now you can think about why the gamma that we see there should appear here. The reason is just that there really are two ways to think about a straight line, even just in the case of flat space. In the case of flat space, a straight line or a straight line segment satisfies, so it is both the shortest line between two points that it connects. It also satisfies the property that the tangent to the straight line, so the properly normalized tangent vector along the straight line is really just the parallel transport of itself. So if you just take the tangent vector of the straight line at one point, and then you parallel transport it along the straight line, you get the tangent vector at a different point. So in other words, and that, and those two aspects of a straight line can be directly generalized to the geodesics on a curved manifold. In other words, actually there's another definition of a geodesic other than being the minimal length curve between two points. It can also be defined as following. This is a second definition for geodesic. It says that, so T here being the tangent vector to the curve, it says that the parallel transport of the tangent vector along the curve itself is the tangent of the curve. That's just the intuition that we all have about straight line in flat space, directly generalized to the curved space. So now, having seen these really ugly symbols, gamma, multiple times, and well, okay, I guess, right, there's one important thing that I still have to tell you about, which is we said that the second way to characterize the curvature is through the fact that the parallel transport of a vector along a closed curve does not have to come back to itself, right? I mean, let's go back here. So here we see that if we parallel transport this vector here, we get that. Along here, we get that. So we can consider parallel transport this vector along a closed curve, goes like that. Then we first go to that vector, and then we'll come back. We'll get the this. So all what I'm saying is that if we say that we parallel transport something along two passes connecting two points, connecting the same two points, if we don't get the same result on the second point, we can also rephrase it as saying if we just parallel the vector along the closed curve consists of these two separate paths, then the vector does not have to come back to itself at the first point that we started with. So we have a curve, which was you have a curved manifold. With some coordinate system on it, and I pick a particular closed path on the manifold, and then I pick a vector here, and I parallel transport it along this path. There's something here, something there, something here, and then I get something here. Okay, this is where we start with. This is what we get. So we don't come back to itself. And it's a really fun calculation to calculate what we get. It's a really fun calculation, but unfortunately, I'm not going to do it for you. Because really, I skipped too many things for me to honestly do the calculation today in front of your eyes. If we have time in the end, I mean, when we finish talking about the fun physics, then I mean, we can come back to say more about this. But I will just show you the result. If we start with the vector, which is called v, and here we get v prime, then what is delta v, which is v prime minus v? It is given by, again, the curvature tensor. Equal A C D. So what I mean by TB and T, what do I mean by T and S here? So V is the vector itself, and T it's fun to use color choice. So say T is the tangent vector along this coordinate curve. Let's see, call this T. And S is this. So let me see what is the proper way to say it. So let's call this coordinate system as T and S. Yeah. So capital T is the tangent vector along a curve defined by the fact that it's S component of the coordinates is constant. And the capital S, which is a vector, is the tangent to the curve defined by the fact that their T component of the coordinates is constant. Well, you can forget about those words, but it is pretty clear what I mean from the picture by T and S. So this says that basically, locally, the failure of the vector being transported along a closed curve to go back to itself, first of all, is proportional to how big the region is. Okay. Delta S times delta. Okay, I forgot to tell you this. So say that point has the coordinate 0, but that point has the coordinate. Its S component don't change, so has the coordinate 0, delta T. This is delta S, delta T. This point is 0, delta S. So delta T is is basically how is the length in terms of the local coordinates of this how do you call this? Of that square-like thing. And there are also higher order terms which are cubic and quartic and blah blah. So this is a power expansion in delta S and delta T. The key thing here is just really, I guess in both cases that I should emphasize that in both these two ways to characterize the curvature, it is actually highly non-trivial. Well, it is. There is some non-triviality built in to these, say, observation, which is really what happens here. When you really calculate, say, delta V here, or the relative, say the relative acceleration over there, when you really strip away these quantities that they characterize either the size and shape of the loop, or the size and the orientation of the loop, and there, the separation and the orientation of the two curves, the two parallel curves, what remains is an object that they transform as a tensor. That is a high, that is something that, without going too deep into the details that you may not be able to understand, but I just hope that you appreciate the fact that when we really do all these things, we get something. Indeed, they have that, many indexes, but objects with, many indexes may not be tensors. They may not, transform very nicely like that, and they're a coordinate, a transformation. But if we just do these operations, we really just get something that is a tensor. That is something that I didn't, or I haven't tell you why. I did not tell you why. But that's something that you should appreciate. Okay, now, I think we're going well with time today. Now we are more or less comfortable with this object. And it has a name called Riemann tensor. Riemann curvature tensor. I just feel that I should tell you the name because really that is a great mathematician who did a lot of contribution to many aspects of math, to many aspects of life, to many aspects of math. Okay, sorry. So now we have this rank 1,3 tensor, and I told you that last time. That what we want to do is to generalize the following equation. Which is a Newton's equation. And I told you that, and also Einstein has the great insight that the proper quantity, the proper mathematical object that should be used to describe gravity following his equivalence principle, as we said last time, is not phi, but an object G mu nu, where G mu nu is the metric tensor of a curved space-time. So here's one thing that I should first say. So what we have been talking about here are for some manifold with a metric that is positive definite. So in all the previous case, the metric G, or Gij, or Gab, is a locally or point-wise is a n by n symmetric a matrix that is positive definite, which you can, by properly choosing a basis to simplify it point-wise to the form, just to the identity of to the identity matrix. But as someone last time pointed out, that in space-time, we know that the metric is not the positive definite. It has depending on your convention, a 1, 3 a signature. So it can locally be diagonalized to say +1, -1, -1, -1. Okay. So there is such a difference. So what happens to all the things that I have just told you? Well, there are both some big differences, and on the other hand, things also carry through very nicely. Basically, all the formulas, you take them, if you stare at them, if you don't see anything, wrong with them, then they will equally apply to the case where the metric has a non-positive definite signature. So everything here essentially all carry through to the case where the signature is changed. The only place that one has to be more careful is in this equation. So in this case, if G locally is like that, then there's a danger. Sorry? I can't hear, sorry. What's the question? Is there a question?
No, I didn't mean to have my hand on the button.
Oh, that's okay, don't worry about that. It's good to know that I can hear you. So there is, when the signature is like +1, -1, -1, -1, then there is the possibility that what appears inside the square root may not be positive. Then we can't take the square root. Okay. So what that says really just that in the case of space-time, there is a causal structure. There's a light cone. So to do that, to show this, we can just take, say, flat Minkowski space. Then you all know that if I take a point, then there is a light cone extended from point. So it's like that. So points inside the cone, if you calculate what is delta S squared, defined by delta T squared minus delta XI, sum over I, is going to be positive. And we say those points are time-like separated from the point P. And for points outside the light cone, that quantity is negative, and they are space-like separated from that point. So what changes, when we move from when we move away from the case where the metric is all positive definite to the case, to the present case, just would be that if the two points A and B are time-like separated, we can still use that formula to calculate the distance between two points along a path. Okay. But if, well, that is not a correct statement. Well, I think you get my point. So the point is that if the tangent vector to the curve point-wise is time-like, by that I mean if you just look at curve, take the tangent vector, and take the light cone on the tangent space of the given point, if that a tangent vector stays inside the light cone on every point along the curve, then the curve is called time-like. It's called a time-like curve. Then you can use that formula to calculate the distance or the length of that time-like curve. And we use a special word, which we call the proper time of, or the proper time difference. The proper time of the time-like curve. And if the curve is space-like, by which I mean the tangent vector along the tangent vector on each point of the curve lies outside the light cone of the tangent space at that point, then we have to change the formula to have a minus sign there to make sure we can take the square root. Then we really just calculate the proper length of this space-like curve. So that's the only thing that changes. You can try to confuse yourself to consider a curve that is partly time-like, partly space-like. There's no point doing it. You can just think about it as two curves. I mean, oh, one more thing that I should emphasize, that if you take a geodesic, then if it is time-like at one point, or in some small region, it is all the way time-like. If it is space-like in some small segment, then it will all the way be space-like. And in this case, because we have a light cone, there is also something. So there are also points lying right on the light cone. So there will be a light rays. So there will also be light-like geodesic. If a geodesic that is light-like, which means that, say, the tangent vector of the geodesic at one point lies precisely on the light cone of the tangent space at that point. That is called a light-like geodesic. And also, if the geodesic is light-like at one point, it will going to be light-like all the way, just in the previous two cases. So when we go from a Riemannian manifold to a Lorentzian manifold, I don't know if that word is say standard or not, but you know what I mean. So there are three classes of geodesics: space-like, time-like, and light-like. But with that comments, everything we have said for the Riemannian manifold carries through to the case where the signature is not positive definite. I mean, to the case where, you know what I mean. So now we just say, Einstein told us that we should focus on this quantity rather than phi. And now we have a question of how to modify that equation. So we said that something that it seems to be easier to guess what should appear on the right-hand side. Here we have the density of matter and fields and blah, blah, blah. That's the energy density or mass density. So what should be generalized? So if we want to consider some tensor equations, the proper object should be just the energy moment tensor that appears on the right-hand side. So let me remind you very quickly the idea of the energy moment tensor. It is a second rank tensor, symmetric. If I write it out as a M by M matrix or D by D matrix, where D is now the dimension of the space-time. And the whole space-time has a signature 1 comma d minus 1. Then and I will call this as 0 component 1 to d minus 1. In other words, I choose x 0 equal to t. That's my convention. Right? So the 0 0 component of that tensor is basically the energy density, and these components were the those components. So this is T0, 0, T0, I, they are the momentum density, yeah. And so since it is asymmetric, I only need to specify or tell you half of it what they are. What is the proper symbol for a momentum density?
I would call pi.
So pi 1, pi 2, pi d minus 1. And so first of all, do you understand what I mean by momentum density, right? So what I mean is that you just take a small region of space, and then you take a small region, and then you choose some coordinate system, and then you can measure what is the momentum of that small region, right? Just think about the small region with some or matter or field in it. Just think about it as some object. Then an object carries a momentum. Then you can ask the question: what is its moment? What is its momentum? It has to be a vector. I mean, it has some components that tells us what is its momentum along the different directions. So that is those are precisely the components of that thing. Right? So you have a space-time, you have some region with some coordinate system x, y, z, and I mean there may be field all over the place. There may be some matter or fluid or block. So yeah, think about a fluid flowing. Just take a small region, then there is an observable, which is what is the momentum of those fluids inside that small region. And then you divide that quantity by the volume of that small region. That gives you the momentum density. That is what appears here, those pi's. And the energy density is just what is the energy of that small region. You measure that, and then you divide that by the volume of the region. That is rho. And these components are called stress. So the whole thing is called energy, momentum, stress tensor. What is stress? Stress basically is, again, think about a fluid. So if we think about what is TXY, TXY is where? It is here, right? Oh, where is it? Yeah, okay, TXY is here. So you just take, is the flux density of the x component of the momentum across. Draw the picture first. Let's say this is x, this is y, then there's a momentum on x. Right, let me call this TXC, not that. So think about the fluid. They may be flowing like that. So they carry some component, so they carry some momentum along the x direction. And well, I guess the picture is not very good. Let me redraw it. So think about a fluid region here. They flow like that. They carry some x component of the momentum. But on the other hand, they also have some motion along the z direction. So there is a quantity that you can talk about, which is what is the amount of the x component of the momentum being transported along the z direction per unit time across an area, across a unit area at a constant with a constant z coordinate, z component of the coordinates. In other words, what is the amount of the x component of the momentum across, for example, the bottom of this cube during a unit amount of time. That is what this Txc is. That is what was called stress. You can also talk about Txx. That would be what is the amount of the x component of the momentum across an area, a small surface located at a place with constant value of x. That would be, say, what is the amount of a momentum across that surface of the cube. What is the amount of the x component of the momentum across that surface of the cube in unit time? So that is what those components are. By the way, these Txx and Tyy, Tzz, if we are in a fluid system that is sort of homogeneous and isotropic, then these are precisely the pressure, right? Just like, I mean, those are the pressure, the local pressure of the fluid. So I guess the point that I should make is that these combinations of things, by definition, is a tensor. I say by definition is because by definition, we just define them by choosing some coordinate system. And when we really change the coordinate system, these things transform, really transform linearly. If we just say squeeze, if we try to rotate the cube, then all these components will correspondingly transform very simply, just as some linear transformation if you follow through the definition of quantity. So that is a tensor. So now when we really try to modify that equation, we basically know what should appear on the right-hand side is what I'm doing. In fact, I don't want to keep this 4 pi here, because I'm not sure it's 4 pi or 8 pi now. I may be wrong by a factor, but it's really not important. It's just T mu nu and times T Newton, some number times pi. So the question is, what should appear on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side? So it had better be something that is a second order derivative of G mu nu. So what object that transforms as a second rank tensor can be built by using second order derivative of G mu nu? That is the question. That was actually the key mass question in eventually writing down the Einstein equation. And that actually took quite a while for Einstein to figure out. And with the benefit of hindsight, we can just write it down directly. We see that we have already a curvature tensor, which is a 1,3 rank tensor. And when we have a tensor like that, say R, A, B, C, D, we can actually build more tensors on top of that. One way to build more tensors is basically say if I have two tensors, like say A, B, C, and B, D, E, F, G, H, whatever. If I just multiply these things together like that, define a new tensor whose components is precisely the product of the two sensors. So I define a new object whose components are the product of the corresponding components of the original two tensors. you can check by the very simple definition of tensors, which we had over there. The new object under coordinate transmission will also transform, but very simply, still just like some component by component, the linear transformation. So this trivially will be a new tensor. Of course, if we try to build tensors that way, the tensor only get bigger and bigger, have more and more components. Given that we have a 1,3 tensor and we want to have a 2, we want to have a 0,2 tensor, this is not enough. It will only give us tensors with higher and higher rank. But there's another operation we can do to build new tensors from some old ones. If I have a tensor which, for example, still A, C, A, B, like that, I can do the following, which is we can do the following, which is we can contract one lower index with one upper index. Let me have more here. So here I can define a new tensor, which goes like, for example, A, C, D, B, B, sum over B. So here you see I put this E to be B and then I sum over B. And that turns out also to be a new tensor. This you have to check a little bit. Basically what happens is that if you do this operation, the new object you get, which now, so A2 is a new object which has three indexes. Its given component like that is defined by that sum of the components of the original tensor. And I claim this new object defined by components now altogether forms a new tensor, meaning that it transforms in the proper way. This you can check yourself, but the bottom line is that when you really contract one upper index with one lower index, basically when we really try to follow that, equation, what one does is that one has to multiply a matrix with its inverse and then just get an identity. We'll get a delta function. So what remains here would be a new tensor. So that is really what we want, because this operation does the job that it can build new tensors with lower rank. So now let's just look at that object. So the natural thing would be just contract this A with one of the lower index. And that defines a new object. Let's call this RAB is RCACD. So we contract that index with that index. That is what we do. And this one is called Ricci tensor. That is a 0,2 tensor, which is nice. Furthermore, oh, I forgot to write you something. I didn't tell you how to write this Riemann tensor in terms of the gamma symbols over there. I do it right now for you. There's a point to make. It's a formula that is ugly, but So the point is that this Riemann curvature tensor is defined in terms of the gamma symbol, which is, by the way, called Christoffel symbol. And it's first the derivatives. And if you remember the gamma symbols, the Christoffel symbols are defined in terms of the matrix, the inverse metric, and the first derivative of the metric, you see that the Riemann curvature tensor is really defined in terms of something including the second derivative of the metric tensor. I mean, it is defined in terms of the metric tensor, its first derivative as well as the second derivative, but no higher derivatives. So that's kind of a nice thing, because that means that both the Riemann tensor as well as the Ricci tensor in the end would involve derivatives of the metric no higher than the second order. And that's kind of nice, because in the equation for Newtonian gravity, we also just have a second order derivative. When we really go from there to here, we don't have to introduce higher order derivatives, which normally may bring some problem. So now the natural guess would be just like, we should just use this Ricci tensor and write an equation like this, A pi G Newton, T A B. And that is indeed what, say, Einstein did some time ago, but it turns out it's not working because the energy moment tensor satisfies a very nice property, which is that it has to be locally conserved, and that means that the covariant derivative of TAB has to vanish. So but RAB does not have that property. So RAB turns out not to be the right quantity to put there. What is the right quantity turns out to be the following. So we have to construct another object from the Ricci tensor. And it is constructed by the following way. Just take RAB. Take RAB and take the metric define this. This is called Ricci scalar. So I guess I didn't really tell you what is this G with upper index. I mean, I probably have forgot to tell you what it is. So we have GAB with lower index is the metric, with the upper index is really just is the inverse of the metric defined in the following way. The other function. Let's see. That turns out to be a tensor equation. So if you can do that in one coordinate system, it holds also in all other coordinate systems. So what GAB is really is the inverse of the metric. So here I just define a new object. So this particular operation is a combination of the two operations we see there. We first multiply two tensors together to get a rank 2,2 tensor. And then we contract both lower and upper indexes. So we get a scalar. We get a 0,0 tensor. So that is called Ricci scalar. And the following object defined by the difference between the Ricci tensor minus 1/2 times the metric times the Ricci scalar is called the Einstein tensor. And it satisfied the property that is covariant, it is covariantly conserved. And that is really what, in the end, should appear in the Einstein equation. So the Einstein equation is this. Too bad it takes us almost the whole class to get here. The whole lecture. So what this says is that basically on the right-hand side is something that describes the distribution of matter, their energy, and blah, blah, blah. And on the left-hand side is something that built out of the metric. Specifically, it involves things like second derivative of the metric. It essentially captures how the space-time is curved because it's really built through the curvature tensors, the Riemann curvature tensor, the Ricci tensor, and Ricci scalar. Okay. So it tells us how matter curves space-time. That is the Einstein equation. And there are altogether, on both sides, they are second rank asymmetric tensor. In four dimensions, they have 10 independent components. So that is really a set of 10 coupled nonlinear partial differential equations, which are highly difficult to solve. So it's striking that people can write down these equations, but now it's still very hard to solve them unless one impose some symmetry conditions. Say when they consider only highly symmetric cases like a spherical asymmetric system. So only in very special cases one can solve. I think there are some very interesting physics points that I want to make. Do you want me to go for another 20 minutes, or you want to leave? Okay, you can just feel free to leave. I can stay here until the last one. If anyone stays, I will just keep going. Now we really want to apply it. So one thing that I want to show you is that this equation implies propagating degrees of freedom in the theory, in the absence of matters, i.e., there are gravitational waves, just like in electromagnetism, there are electromagnetic waves, right? So to see that, actually, we can simplify our life a little bit to consider cases where the gravity is weak. If we do that, so what that means is that we consider a space-time metric, which is almost flat, which is almost flat, plus some small deviation on top of the flat Minkowski metric. So gamma mu mu is much component by component is much less than one. If we do that, then it turns out that the whole Einstein equation simplifies dramatically with a proper choice of gauge. So there is a gauge choice involved. You have heard about gauge choice from E&M, right? Gauge choice, in E&M, there are, say, Lorentz gauge, which looks like that, or say temporal gauge A0 equal to 0, or some other things. So it comes from the fact that there is some redundancy in the equation, meaning that you can change the variables in the equation, keeping the whole equation fixed, or meaning that if you choose some data initially, that is not enough for you to determine the future solution or the future solution of the equation, because you can always change your gauge choice. In the present case, there is a very physical way to think about what we mean by a gauge freedom here in the context of gravity. So here we always can choose the local coordinates. If we choose, say, we take the same spacetime, we take the same spacetime with the same curvature, with all the properties same, but we choose a different coordinate systems, then we will get g mu nu component by component, pointwise, having different values. So if we take just the same think about the same manifold with the same property, but if we choose a different local coordinates, then the values of these tensors, components by components, will be different. That's a gauge choice. So that's a freedom that we should fix by just committing ourselves to some pre-chosen or some fixed coordinate system. Okay. So, and if we have the following gauge choice, which can be chosen, which by the way is a direct generalization of the Lorentz gauge, then the whole Einstein equation reduced to a very simple form . Okay, so here's the detail, which is the gamma bar is really related to gamma in some simple way, which is really doesn't matter that much, but I'll just tell you. The point is that that equation is precisely a wave equation. So this comes from Einstein equation. Applies to the case of weak gravity with the following gauge choice or gauge fixing. We get that. Okay. So that is a wave equation that tells us that there is something that's propagating in the theory in the same way as there is something propagates in Maxwell's theory. So one difference is that in Maxwell's theory, it is described by a field called A nu, but here we have this gamma rho sigma. It has two lower indexes. That is the major difference here. What it means is that in the case of E and M, the photon, which is the proper way to, which is the quantum that really, in the end, quantize the electric magnetic wave, the photon is a spin one particle. But in gravity, the quantum of gravity, which is called a graviton, is a spin two particle. The spin really is just something that you can read off from the number of indexes. But you know from quantum mechanics that a spin two particle has five polarizations, because the number of polarizations is 2j plus 1 in four dimensions. So it has five polarizations. But in fact, for graviton, there are only two polarizations. The other three goes away precisely because of the gauge freedom. But just like in the case of photon has spin one, but photon only has two polarizations, right? I mean, I thought you probably have learned something about the quantum mechanics. So the photon only has two polarizations, but a spin one particle should have three if you just count very, very naively. So there, it is also due to the gauge freedom that you can get rid of some of the polarizations. So here, the point I want to say is that it's 5 minus 3 = 2. That is the real number of physical polarizations of graviton as well as gravitational wave. So can we have some physical intuition of how the gravitational wave look like, just like we have some intuition of how the E field and B field behave for the electromagnetic wave? Yes, we can. So think about in space, we have a ring of particles. in an empty space. And now think about there's a train of plane gravitational wave propagating through the space-time, transfers to the blackboard, going out of the blackboard. And we can understand properties of the gravitational wave by observing how the particles move. Right? So I will just draw you the picture, how they will move. Where do I want to be great? So there are precisely two polarizations. One is, so we start from a circle. And then circle becomes fat, fat, fatter, less fat, go back to zero, and then thin, thinner. Okay. That's one polarization. That's a whole period. That is a whole cycle. Another polarization is like this, circle. So what it does is that this start here, and then zoom, and then shrink, 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 and then re-expand, and then shrink, 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 and then re-expand. That is a whole cycle. This is only half a cycle. That is the whole cycle. And this, and the second one is just rotate the first one by 45 degrees. So that is one particular choice of the two polarizations. And as you know from E&M, there are different choices of polarizations, just taking some linear combination of them, which may be time dependent. And then you can talk about a left move, say left-handed and right-handed. So that's just one basis choice. Those are the two polarizations. That's gravitational wave. Right, and one thing is that now, basically that's essentially how people try to observe the gravitational wave. So it is just the fact that the gravitational wave is some sort of a ripple on the space-time curvature. It changes the length of a ruler, say for example, or it gives some speed to particles. So that is essentially one way to observe them. You can try to build up some interference experiment where one leg of the interferometer changes its length, so you will see some interference pattern change. That is the idea how to observe these waves. And now you can ask, we know they propagate. Where do they come from? There are many astrophysical processes that can emit a gravitational wave. But the point is that this is a very weak effect. So if you think about a rod, a rotating rod, a ruler rotating, if the whole ruler weighs one kilogram with length 1 meter, rotating at a frequency 1 hertz, then the energy of gravitational wave being emitted per unit time is like 10 to the minus 47 Earth or 10 to the minus 54 joules. So that's a very, very weak, very, very weak effect. And that really makes the amplitude of the gravitational wave emitted by some very far away astrophysical object when they reach the Earth, those amplitudes will be very, very weak, very, very small. So up to this day, we still do not have a convincing direct observation of gravitational wave. But we do have indirect evidence for them. So in the year of 1975, two gentlemen, I forgot their name, they observed a binary system, which somewhere in the sky, I mean, in the universe, which consists of two compact objects rotating around each other. So the maximum distance between the two objects along the orbit is kind of small, is on the scale of the size of the sun. That means that there will be some a very strong gravitational field locally, and that makes makes the effect of a general relativity appreciable and is a good source of gravitational wave radiation. One of the object is a pulsar, which is an object that basically emit some radio wave in some very pointed manner. So the radio radiation goes like some beams, and they are rotating. Only when the beam is shined toward us, we are able to see them. So they act like a clock. By measuring the frequency of when this beam, we can see them. That's like a clock through which we can measure how fast these two objects rotate around each other. Over many years, the data get more and more accurate. One finds that there is a speed up of the frequency, which is precisely which agree very well with what one would calculate by taking into account the fact that the two objects would emit a gravitational wave and lower their energy, and then getting closer and closer and rotating around each other faster and faster. So that's a very good indirect evidence of the fact that there should be gravitational radiation. I guess I will skip the Newtonian limit. So I will just say some words. If in addition to consider just weak gravity, one also require that the gravitational field is slowly varying in time. So not only its magnitude is small, but its variation with time is also small. And also if one require the fact that all the matter, or there is a frame of choice in which all the matter around are moving very slowly, much slower than the speed of light, in that limit, one can reduce the Einstein equation just to that form. And here, phi would be just the zero component of the metric tensor. So in that particular limit, we will reproduce Newtonian gravity, and phi is just one particular component of the metric. And also, if in that limit one try to reapply the geodesic equation, which is somewhere up there, and one will get basically the acceleration, which is d2x dt just minus gradient of phi. That is just what we say, that the gradient of phi acts like a force, say acting on the particle. So the geodesic equation you see is an equation of the second time derivative of xi plus something else equal to zero. That something else is built by the derivative of the metric, right? So here, I told you phi is precisely one component of the metric. So the point is that what appears here on the right-hand side is really just a first derivative of the metric. So there is, although I didn't show you how to derive it, the structure really matches. So it is something about second derivative of x equal to something about the first derivative of the metric. So the Newtonian limit comes out really right, as one should expect. And I still have a few words to say about Schwarzschild black hole. But given that we are late, I guess I can cut it off here. I guess I should have given the lecture like this at the last time, and there will be more people here. Thank you.